And hello, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, which comes to you on most weekdays and random weekends at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. And you might be viewing this on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance or the Facebook page of KBOO Community Radio or any number of my own little platforms on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, VK, LinkedIn, Twitch. It goes out as a podcast afterwards if you look for This Week with David Rovics, wherever you get your podcasts. And today we are with a wonderful panel of artists who are all contributors to issue number 51 of World War III Illustrated, which is a fabulous sort of publication in print and now also online and with a great website too that's been going on for like 40 years now. And there Susan has the latest print edition. Wow, so colorful. Oh, we have multiple print editions in different households. Wonderful. And starting conversations is always the hardest part because there's a zillion places to go, but I'm just I think it's 2020. We're in the middle of a pandemic and things are all very different than they normally are, and I thought we might start with just talking about how the pandemic has been impacting anybody's art and work and how you guys are all surviving to whatever degree you survive as artists. I don't know, but it's a tough time for artists and other cultural workers and a whole lot of other people. But and maybe start with Susan, perhaps. Oh, you're muted though. There you go.
Hi, everybody. Good to see you. I'm pretty much isolated at home, but the movements keep on going on. So artwork is going to immigrants' rights stuff and Black Lives Matter here in Milwaukee and doing weird things like painting flags for people, making masks. But the isolation is really hard. Art shows are still going on, and I'm delivering stuff for shows that are online. But I'll be kind of sitting back because I was just interviewed by David recently and pass it on to the rest of you. Go ahead, Sasha.
Hi, everyone. I'm in Brooklyn, New York, and yeah, I mean, I usually, my sort of main job is teaching. I teach actually pottery, ceramics, and I've had like a bunch of, I've been laid off, I've been on unemployment, I've had some teaching, so it's definitely been hard. But yeah, same thing. I've been trying to make art for, you know, flyers and posters. I've been, I just printed, there was a zine that I compiled that Annabelle also contributed to, that we were gonna have at the New York City Feminist Zine Fest, but that was in March, like March 20th or something. So that's been indefinitely postponed, but I decided to print it finally because it's just a great zine and I'm hoping to, you know, sell that a little bit among online or family and friends and save it for when hopefully there can be a zine fest again.
Same here. Terry.
I didn't know what order we're going in.
I think, are we all looking in the same order where Sasha's in the upper right and then Terry's in the lower left? So maybe we just go around in that, what is that, clock, the direction of the clock, right? Yeah.
Sure.
Or no, that's not right. That would be a circle. No, that would be two. No, up to like left to right, then left to right. There we go.
That's a,
but then if we were in Japan, we go right to left. Oh, Terry. Yes, please.
Okay. Right now I am working on a lot of things in the studio, but mainly tattooing. I doubled my studio space and I rented another place here. So I'm tattooing independently, but, That's been uneven just because of when there was a total shutdown, I couldn't, and I was taking care of my daughter and me. So I got a job as a welder at a sanitation place. Right when the pandemic hit, I did that so that, you know, it wouldn't be shut down, and it got shut down. So I took a job in a laundromat, and then that got shut down. So I've just basically been trying to paint and working on some writings, things like that here in the studio. But it's been rough, especially, you know, I have a lot of friends and relatives still in the South, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, and there's been no help for those people. They've lost. They don't have any income. So, you know, it's been, I love being alone. So just time to be with my work has been fantastic, but the external world has been stressing me out.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Finish your sentence.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, I don't know why, but so much of my focus has been shifting through writing at this time. And I've got an editor helping me in Europe, and that's my contact. But it seems like there's less visual stimulation, you know, in the hermitage.
Less visual stimulation. Yeah, right. As with the isolation. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in Brooklyn, New York, and let's see. I feel like it's like this moment makes me realize how important art is, just as like this is something that shows us the possibility of the cracks that will allow us to organize into, you know, whatever, like imagination is the only thing that is going to save us from pandemic and uprising and fascism and climate crisis. And so it feels like a really good moment to sort of lean into that making and creating. The flags and masks and flyers that Sasha and Susan were mentioning are a place where you can see like imagination is the only hope to save us all. So thanks.
I would definitely echo that. Myself haven't had a lot of free time to make a lot of work in the last couple of months, but just seeing the work that other people are making is like a buoy and kind of keeping me afloat. I wouldn't say I've had a really hard time, but you know, everything is shifted in a way. My work went virtual. I'm a caregiver for my dad. So that responsibility has increased. Just being in Detroit and the pandemic hit us pretty hard early on. People already have a really hard time in Detroit. So it's just been a challenging time.
One thing we all right here share in common is we're all artists in the United States. And I wonder what have people's experiences been with any kind of help from any form of the government, and also in terms of substantial forms of mutual aid that may have been going on in terms of helping artists or anybody else in your community. But I'm kind of particularly interested in artists and how people have been surviving, and whether any of this aid that we keep hearing about on the radio has actually come through to people, say, for example, in this panel. And I'd like to keep you in the conversation too, Susan. I mean, I think these aren't necessarily questions that we were talking about before.
Well, go ahead then. I'm on Medicare, which is wonderful, and Social Security. And pensions from my job. So I have a steady income. My children who are in their 40s are working. One child is working from home, and the other one works in a lab with full protective equipment. So we're okay, but my community, we have a lot going on. The main thing going on that's really interesting is street murals everywhere. Black Lives Matter street murals about victims of police murder. Nobody is getting any money for it. Some people are getting a little, not government money. Communities and people who own stores are contributing money for supplies and to the artists. But there's tremendous unemployment. I've lots of friends who are teachers, and the teachers are teaching online and very stressed out. And so I will end there.
That's great. I love it. It's just what you've just been saying is also like, you know, we're all in such different situations. Everybody, you know, depending on your, where you are and what, you know, your generation and whether you have another job or whether you own a house or you're renting. And I mean, there's any number of things, but I think it's all totally relevant. So I'll just butt out now. And after that little comment, Sasha, please.
Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned before, I've been on unemployment since April because my job was at first said they would sort of keep us on for virtual stuff and it wasn't really working. And then they said, you know, we're just going to let you go and have you be on unemployment, which honestly, especially when there was the extra pandemic assistance was, I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, I was making more than I had been.
Did it come through quickly?
It for me, it did. I definitely heard people that had a lot of issues with it in New York. And, you know, actually, even one of my coworkers didn't get it for a long time. And they were like tweeting at the Department of Labor because you couldn't like call them. So that was interesting. But for me, luckily, it was fine. And then, I mean, it's just been an interesting calculation with like when there are opportunities to go back to work, whether it actually, I mean, I don't get very many hours. You can teach this class for 2 hours. So is it even worth it? Because then I don't get unemployment for that day. So it's kind of a weird patchwork of things. And it's kind of interesting. But I think that pandemic assistance, obviously it should have been continued because that really like did help a lot. I mean, it made me be able to go through this without being worried.
Because before the pandemic, your survival was probably consisted of a weird patchwork of things, right? I mean, it was that's how it is, right? But then with the pandemic, it's a whole different weird patchwork. And a more selective patchwork.
Yeah.
Terry?
Yeah. When normally I teach and I sell my art, my tattoo. And if there's ever a lull, I've done a lot of trade work and things. I could jump into that. But when everything dried up, I didn't think I would get unemployment. So I took a welding job, like I said, and that all the customers, you know, CVS and things went on a will call. So they didn't, they rebuilt sanitation equipment. And so that dried up. So I applied for unemployment here in New York State and got it. And that helped. But, I've noticed like my tattoo, like nobody's buying art, obviously, and there's no teaching, there's nothing else. So a third of my tattoo customers have been making their regular money and have nothing to spend it on, so they're spending more. And a third of them are struggling and a third are destitute. But that's, you know, my daughter, she worked in Kentucky most of last year, even though she's here. And so her unemployment had to come from Kentucky. And it's probably the worst or one of the very worst states I've dealt with their unemployment. They crashed their system. They've got 100,000 people that have received nothing so far. And just dealing with that, it's beyond Kafkaesque. I've had to go and sleep after dealing with it and help her. So, these terrible stories of people like losing. There was an old man, and he said, you know, I need, what was that? I need my water, I believe it was, or something that powered oxygen equipment, something like that. I was reading this online as I'm looking at trying to get in touch with the unemployment agency. in Kentucky. And he had tried everything, and they were shutting it off. And he said, you know, they don't know that I'll die. Like, when they shut it off, I am dead. And it's just, it's madness. You know, the funniest thing is I've had a lot of people, because they're, they've got substance abuse problems. I don't hold this against anyone, but I still, like I said, I have a lot of hillbillies that I'm in touch with, and they've gone insane. And I shouldn't laugh at it, but they laugh at it. But they quit drinking, or they quit taking pills, or they've lost their psychotropic prescription. And one guy told me, he's a veteran, and they cut off all his benefits. And he was coming to New York to see me to get some tattoo. He had proposed to a woman and driven his truck off a cliff. And it was just, you know, you watch this, and I finally realized when this is happening, like I said, I shouldn't laugh at, but it's the madness of life, that they've just gone nuts. Like, whatever it is that's been sustaining their brains is gone. And one guy went for a week. I watched from a computer here in my studio as he went absolutely nuts, and prophesied, spoke to Jesus, promised to invade New York City, and finally got calmed down. It's been madness in one way and another, good and bad.
Yeah, just visiting Jerusalem can make some people go crazy. You know, who knows?
Reading the Bible, all the serial killers. Yeah, so.
Annabelle, how about reflections on survival?
Well, first I want to say I'm incredibly fortunate. So this comic that Sasha and I did for World War III Illustrated is about the affordable housing cooperative that I live in. And we were just having our board meeting immediately before this. And Rebecca, who's our president, was just reminding and reflecting how lucky we are and how grateful we should all be to have an affordable roof over our heads, you know, that was the product of much struggle. But yeah, and I work for paid work. I do corporate research and policy research for a number of labor unions and racial justice groups. And so I've been able to do that research from home during the pandemic. So I personally am very, very fortunate. I've many loved people who have survived COVID and are sort of playing a role in the uprisings. And we're engaged in a big struggle right now to stop a fracked gas pipeline through Brooklyn, because obviously fracked gas in the most densely populated city in the country, great idea.
Wow.
So yeah, I've been getting to work with folks from the No North Brooklyn Pipeline, Brownsville Green Crew. And that's, yeah, so just personally really grateful, and also watching and sort of trying to think of how to play the best role possible in the multiple forms of intersecting devastation around us. Beck?
So I don't make art for a living. At one time in my life, I did have a variety of patchwork part-time jobs to work on artwork mostly as my focus. And I decided for me, it was a trap. It was going to be a focus on what sells. You know, it's very hard when you are struggling to pay rent to think about what art makes your heart sing instead of what's going to sell. So I guess right now I don't have as much time for art, but I'm fortunate that I don't have to sell art for a living. But I respect anyone for any path that they choose. So I'm a full-time speech-language pathologist in Detroit Public Schools. And that itself has been a challenge.
Mm.
But
how is that working out? Online? Is it all online?
It's online as of this week. Until this week, this school year, we had about a third of the student population going into the schools. And I also worked in a hybrid model. Yeah, I mean, I think working in a district like this is challenging in the best of times, but it's also like a source of joy and hope, because just being able to work with young people and all the amazing teachers, and it definitely like contributes to my resilience whenever I'm not in a moment when I'm exhausted from work.
So just for the record, here in Portland, here in Oregon, there are, last I heard, there were 400,000 unemployed people. 100,000 of them are gig workers. Of those gig workers, I think 70,000 of them are still waiting. So it's really like Kentucky, and I am one of them. And actually, I'm not still waiting. I got 16 individually mailed rejections in the mail yesterday. And I first applied at the beginning of April for unemployment, but I'm one of the lucky ones who has other sources of income, like crowdfunded patronage, which is but it's crazy with the employment department out here in Oregon. It's very much like Kentucky, which people might not realize. And I've been hearing about the competent employment department in New York, but one of the things that's been a lot in NPR and various other news sources that are often discussing the state of society and the decaying state of society and the lack of money with the lack of a second bailout. And, one of the things that this is leading to for a lot of people is just a reevaluation of everything about how this whole society works, about, of course, why it is essential workers are the ones most often dying of COVID-19, and the inequities in society that are so starkly exposed by the pandemic and by the inept government response to it, and everything else is causing a lot of reimagination and reevaluation of the whole reality of what we might call latter-day American capitalism. But I wonder if people have been thinking a lot about that more than usual, about how we might have a society that is both not just more equitable in general, but also a some kind of way that artists could actually prosper and create and not only survive, but really just all whatever comes to mind as far as the problems that exist in this society for trying to be an artist. And also, along with that, I wonder if to what degree is the struggling artist notion actually accurate? How much is struggling helpful, and how much is it not helpful? Because I think there's a real kind of weird dynamic there with that in my own life as an artist. And I wonder if any of that, if people have any reflections on anything related to what I just said, starting with Susan. Is that?
Yeah. Well, I should just say that I'm an RN. retired. So the struggles that people are having on the front lines, and the lack of protective equipment, and my last job was working in a high school as a school nurse. So people I know are on the front lines, and I'm following what's going on very closely and know exactly what's wrong on a very professional level, on how things are being mismanaged, and it's very frustrating. But again, World War III is exactly that question, the world we're fighting for. And the topics that we have picked and people pick for this issue are very much those questions. The society we're fighting for is one where we don't have to be in the streets demonstrating and getting beaten up and arrested to bring issues out into public view. I mean, the power that we have is to create the issues and the focus that bring people together against an unjust system. And that's, I think, at the heart of what brings us together as artists. In terms of a society that respects artists and where people can make a living doing art, I think it's a perennial problem worldwide. When artists have to sell their work in a capitalist marketplace where art, and I certainly heard Beck talking about the difference between doing artwork as your political voice and versus doing artwork that's going into the marketplace and you have to sell it and it has to please people and they, to be able to look at it on their walls. And many of us do artwork that people would not want to have to look at every day because it's really pretty direct and harsh. Throw that out to you all.
Yeah. I also felt like it was very, I could relate to what you said, Beck, about making the decision about whether you want to take the really big risk of trying to just support yourself with art and whatever that goes with it, which I feel like, you know, I've just always been terrible at making a nice looking Instagram account or anything like that. And it's not, I know that people just do what they have to do to be able to make a living that way, but it's hard. And I don't know, I'm still haven't decided whether I want to do that or whether I think it, in a way, it does make more sense to get your money somewhere else and just always have art be a part of your life. And something I was thinking is that, I mentioned that zine before, and I've done a couple of those where I've just asked friends, and I'm friends with some artists, but most of my friends aren't necessarily artists, but everyone, you know, a lot of people I asked contributed something. And whether, writing or a little drawing or collage. And I think that most people have some impulse in them to want to do that kind of stuff, reflecting on the world, making something fun and creative and beautiful that can communicate with other people. I think that that's more so than some sort of career is more just something that's a part of all humans' expression that everyone should be able to do. So I think that in terms of thinking about a world that we're fighting for, I would love it if there was some government funded program where I could just get paid to do some paintings of cool, interesting things all the time. But at the same time, I think there has to be more sharing of both the responsibility for essential functions and the ability to do art. Yeah.
Well, I think from listening to people, there's a lot more receptivity to the idea that this economy is a sham. You know, that that there's no point in trade and there's no point in money. Making art right now and looking at the billions and billions that are being made by the oligarchs, I have a feeling I had when I was a kid. I grew up very poor and there was no money in the community. So whether or not you made art was irrelevant. You wanted to, you did. It wouldn't benefit you economically. Now I have that same feeling because, there's so much money floating around that a lizard like Bezos or Bloomberg or any of these people, they could give $1 million to every individual in the United States and not even have not even noticed that on their spreadsheet. So I think a lot of people have seen that. And, you know, I had this radio program for a year and a half talking about, it's called The Other Future, talking about this other future we used to dream about. And, you know, anarchists, communists, all these wonderful people we used to predict we would get to. And now the future is being obliterated. So the program was looking at people that that were still working on that other future, whether it was in obscurity or whether they were noticed. And now I noticed that a lot of people are very open to this idea that we can live other ways. You know, I saw there's a little place in the middle of the very poorest part of the country, Whitesburg, Kentucky, a coal country, and they do amazing work. It's called Apple Shop. But they had a job opening, and I was going to apply to it, but I'm here in New York City. And I was fascinated because the premise of the job is that we can have an economy that functions on art. And this is something that, as a joke, as a serious moment for inquiry, I guess, I've said to people. So the fact that someone had gotten a grant to hire someone to go around and collect stories or something, I don't know what in the heck we're doing. But the idea, the fact that they're moving forward with this ludicrous idea, you know, that we could live off art, not selling art, but I don't even know what that means. But the fact we live on printed money that doesn't even exist is as ludicrous as that. So I think the irreality of the economy and the fact that it's just an engine for suffering is really coming to people's the forefront of their mind.
Yeah, I really agree, and it really resonates what you said, how much this sort of shows up the economy for the lie that it is. And just, anytime that I stop to like take a breath and think about it, I'm so angry that we are 9 months into this global pandemic and frontline healthcare workers don't have personal protective equipment. We don't have Medicare for all or some guaranteed income. Again, like you said, Jeff Bezos could fund it all very easily. And just like remembering that we live in a world where if people had enough money to live, many of us would be creating in different ways. And, you know, thinking like, yeah, anything from the Works Progress Administration, where they really did just pay artists to make art, to, you know, similar systems exist in Canada today. Like it doesn't, the world doesn't have to be this way. And sort of how can we imagine that? I love the way you said it, Terry, I'm not capturing it exactly, but the sort of like the future that we want to build. Thank you. Beck?
I totally agree with what folks have said. I don't think capitalism plays well with creativity. Unfortunately, that's the reality that we live in right now, at least. There were two main things that made me choose to not try to make art for a living. One was that I knew an artist who was extremely successful, you know, had pieces in the MoMA, had a studio that, you know, printed her work, had administrative assistants who read her emails and responded and scheduled her flights. And what she said that she wanted most in the world was she wanted more time to make art. And I just thought, okay, you have someone doing all this work for you, actually printing your artwork, and you don't have time to make art. That just made me realize there's nowhere to get to. Like, I can just be grateful for the time that I have, rather than thinking like, oh, well, one day I'll have all the time to make art. And the other one is this culture that we have of making artists compete. I'm really opposed to this this way that people put out these competitions. And I realize I'm in a privileged place financially now, but I refuse to submit my work for any competitions. Every time someone sends me something like that, I say, well, I'm not going to apply. if you want me as an artist, that's different. They're creating competition among artists in the same way that capitalism kind of picks at our soul. This is not what makes the best art. Artists are meant to cooperate. And I don't think the competition aspect of it is very helpful. It's very damaging actually to artists and their psychics. So I really don't know what the answer is, but I think it has to do with something with what Annabelle said earlier about the cooperative housing. I think the solution is when we think about what do we consider a living? When we say to make a living, what is a living? What do we actually want? We want housing. We want to have food. We want to be able to make our art. We want community. So just things like mutual aid, but not because we have to, but because we want to. Because we want to be in community and share things with other people, and that's how we want to do it. So that's one idea that I have.
I want to follow up on that and ask a question. That's a very, you know, this idea of the artist being an isolated genius, drawing the ideas from their unconscious, blah, blah, blah. That's not us, okay? How do people feel about the idea of, even though when you're involved in a political movement, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of energy, but to me, it's what makes me create art. So the relationship of being in the streets and seeing where the art needs to go and seeing art being used in the movements is a whole, well, it's what we like to do. What do y'all think about that whole idea?
Yeah. We were going to talk about this at some point, but I got involved in World War III because Annabelle and I were in a class with Seth about making political comics. And when I saw the class, I was really, really excited because I had been sort of, I like comics and I had been sort of making little comic things. And I obviously, I had political opinions and it was very important to me to find some way to express that and combine those two things. And I guess I'm still figuring that out. But I think like it's interesting to think about. I like it, I guess, because it's like you have to think about not just like what do I want to make, but where do I want it to go, and like what position, how will it contribute, I guess. And I think that's an important thing to think about.
For me, I mean, I make art for a variety of reasons. I do have the, you know, pulling things from my unconscious, like the push of images, you know, that you feel that have to come out, and then the kind of day labor, you know, drawing from life, and that real, real committed egoist type of work you do, you know, with art, with the craft. And then there's, like you're talking about with political work, you know, especially right now with all these writings that I'm doing, you know, it's, you can see the echoing of contemporary motions. I hate to say movement, but, you know, the flux of the time coming through and pushing against that as well. And then creepy little elements that must come from your damaged psyche as well. So I see all of that. I love World War III in the sense that, you know, when I met Seth many years ago in Washington, he was giving a presentation at SPX, and you have all these comic creators. When I went to his talk, I already knew what World War III was about, but the talk was so Seth did that kind of I don't know what word to use for it. It's a bombastic presentation, you know, very punched enunciation of what he was saying, and it seemed to turn some people off. I thought, you know, this is fantastic because the work is engaged. It actually is moving around outside of the page, outside of the screen as he was presenting. And we had a conversation about that afterward. And I mean, I love that, you know, it's like with tattooing, when you do something that's not, it's actually really nice and you see it on someone, has some meaning. The art's actually somewhere instead of a box that at a, you know, a collector's storage who's acquired it as an asset. That's excellent.
What conference was that? Just for people I don't know what.
It's a Small Press Expo. It's one of the two big independent comic creator conferences. There's that, and there's one called the Alternative Press Expo, APE, in San Francisco. And I haven't kept up with them for a while because they got a little more highfalutin. That was 98, and in 98, you just paid for a table. And so they had I was with a guy from Texas that was producing comics, and Bethitis was a weatherman from Minnesota or Michigan who had he was producing the craziest comics. He was producing them on candy wrappers, little books, and he had the big fat guy, and he had himself drawn in a diaper on a cross that said, my baloney has a first name from that commercial. It was so beautifully irreverent, but they wouldn't allow that now. I mean, you have to have some pedigree as a creator. It was wilder then. And when I saw that World War III was there, and I'd loved them since I was a kid in the 80s, I went and then tested this presentation. And it was just beautiful. It was much more Wild West, anarchistic. Now if you look online, it's a lot more streamlined and professionalized. Much less interesting.
I think one thing that I appreciate about what Seth says, I think getting back to your question, Susan, about art and activism is just the reminder that it's like capitalism is gonna make you think that you need to choose between making your art and sort of being active and political in the world. And like, just Seth is really good at that reminder that like, you don't have to choose, that the two feed each other. And like, if you feel like you have to choose, that will impoverish you. So yeah, I think it's like to really feel deeply the injustices in the world and like wanna share and bear witness to the stories of people in my community in different ways. To highlight those as a way of, you know, imagining that future that we all tried to imagine in this edition of the comic.
I guess for me, I like art for art's sake. Like, I like art in general. But I'm not motivated to just make something abstract or something that's not giving a message. So that's, I've just always been like that. I just always feel like I need to feel the passion and the purpose in order to see it through. And, you know, in the last several years, I've had the opportunity of people contacting me and saying, you know, can we use your art for to make yard signs about this political movement? Or can I get a tattoo of your art? Or can I put it on some t-shirts to raise money for an immigrant rights group, or whatever way that they're adding their creativity to mine, is wonderful. Just to you know, let it go out into the world like that and mean something to more and more people, and they put their own meanings on it. It kind of just keeps me going.
I was, Susan, I don't, were you talking? You're muted at the moment. Were you saying something?
I was just going to point out that we're writing our own stories as well as doing the drawings or collaborating with somebody who's involved in the same issue. So we're doing graphic journalism. We're telling the untold stories, the stories of cooperation, the stories of people stepping up and being heard in the community. But we're being the issues that are being censored and not covered by the mainstream press. And we do research. We're out there figuring out what the key issues of the time are. How have you come to do that? What brought you to do that storytelling, that graphic story sequential kind of art?
Well, I was thinking about this because you said that this might be one of the questions that you had, and I looked back at some old notebooks where I think the first comics I did were like this, you know, street scenes in New York, or like this funny job that I had. So I don't know, I just felt like a nice way to like kind of, yeah, capture a scene and make something more permanent that I wanted to remember. And so the comic that I did for World War III Illustrated was with Annabelle about the co-op's buildings that she lives in. And because of a job that I used to have at a nonprofit that worked with those buildings, we knew each other before. And I had actually done some interviews with members of some of her neighbors, like oral history type interviews. And that was something I was really interested in doing because it was just really interesting to interview those people, and it helped me really understand, you know, I'm sort of new to New York, and it helped me understand New York a lot better and that neighborhood and just, you know, a lot of things about housing. And I think it's easier to understand a lot of those big picture things through somebody's story because it's very relatable thinking about, you know, that's just someone's life. So then that just kind of, we put it into a comic format. And I think it was really cool and it was fun because we got to show it to them, and I think they appreciated seeing that, you know, or they felt like in some way that it did accurately represent that experience. You know, we tried to really include details, like we looked at photos of things, or we got old photos from them. And for me, it was like a personal, it was really satisfying to know that like we had thought about those little details, and it really felt like it made a difference to the story.
Are you asking what brought us to do this particular story, or what brought us to comic?
Well, you can answer either or both.
Oh.
I was asking more about telling the story rather than doing an individual illustration or a painting or some other format?
I'll take it in a more broader sense. For me, you know, I've always drawn and not always painted, but since I was 12 or so. But I love to draw and I love stories. And as a kid, I grew up in a fairly rural area. So the only art you could find was a comic book. And I would go to essentially junk stores, but and get all the comics I could, and quickly ran through, Marvel, and then into Weird Stories and all the rest of that. And I love these, but I find myself really, I like the stories to be a high literature, or to be apropos to life in some way, and not men in spandex or something like that. So I'm attracted to being able to tell these kind of tales, you know, and the fact that there are a lot of people, especially younger people, that I can give something like World War III to, and they pick it up and read it. You know, my son, he really wasn't very interested in talking about politics at all. I gave him the Chris Hedges, Yosako piece, Days of Revolt, and immediately reading it and talking. My daughter's friend, she's 18. Before she was 18, I could give them, I would buy World War III for her, and it gets passed around. And her friends, they don't want to be engaged politically, but they are curious about the world. They may not be reading, Proudhon or somebody, but they want to know. And now it leads to these other discussions. The piece, for instance, I did in this issue, that stemmed from, like I said, this radio show and this book of interviews I've been producing on this other future. I remember as a kid, we were talking about cities under the sea. We were talking about super psychedelics you could take that would increase, your consciousness and these abilities you have and extended life. And, there was the potential of techno magic, of life as art. And now we've got fucking climate change and these half-wit baboons running around, beating gay people on the head. And this is not what we were planning. So I was able to put, a little of that in the story so that, we remind each other that there was this brighter future we planned. But I like telling stories in that way. It seems much more accessible to some people. And it seems like a part of my own psyche, soul, whatever, needs a ration of little drawing.
It's such a good question. I've loved comics, I would say, since I was 3 years old, and I can still recite Where the Wild Things Are from end to end. And then as a kid, I was obsessed with Calvin and Hobbes, many, many, many kinds of comics. But I think it took a very long time for me to internalize that they could be for me, maybe because all the heroes were boys. Then Seth from World War III Illustrated was teaching a political comics class at Mayday Space, which is a political art space in Brooklyn. I think that was what really sort of gave me the space. And so Sasha and I worked together on this comic about the history of my building, which was cool because we got to partner with UHAB, the organization where Sasha used to work, and Interference Archive. Which is an amazing movement, art space, and archive in Brooklyn, New York, as well. And so, just sort of getting to connect in a wider way with sort of this universe of organizations, and getting to amplify the stories again of my neighbors who I hear every day. And it was pretty magical to be able to make that comic for people and have people so lit up to see themselves as the heroes of the story. So yeah, that.
Oh, I love that. I was really honored to be a part of this World War III episode, or publication because as a teenager, I was really into World War III illustrated comics. It was really influential to me in terms of my development as an artist. And at that time, I made a lot of little zines that were basically comics that had sort of a magical realism vibe, and also, you know, addressed emotions as well as political realities. Since then, I really hadn't made a comic until they asked me to be a part of this project. I have a degree in fibers. I have spent a lot of time weaving. And then I, you know, got into Just Seeds and making prints, one-off print designs. So I hadn't really attempted to make a comic for many years. I thought it was challenging to play all those roles and to create the format and fit it all into a couple pages. But like definitely a worthwhile challenge. And I was really excited to see what everyone else made as well.
Can I? I just want to sort of going off of some of the things that folks have said in response to a couple of the different questions about the about art and the idea, the sort of the different ideas of, on the one hand, art is something that anybody can do, and we all have the capacity to create art and to express ourselves in all sorts of different ways, on the one hand. But on the other hand, there's some kind of objective, I know it's a very loaded word, but if we can use like an idea of whether something is really good or really working. And like as a musician, as a songwriter, I simply say to people who are wondering how to write a good song, well, if it's a funny song, sing it in front of an audience in a quiet room where the audience is actually able to hear you and everything. They should laugh. If it's a sad song, if it's about, like, say, a refugee who died, and you're singing it in front of a group of refugees who speak English, they should be crying by the end of the song. Otherwise, it's not a sad song. Otherwise, you failed at whatever you were trying to do. If you were trying to write a song that would move the people you're writing about, you know, then if they're crying, it worked. And I just wonder if on that whole question of not what makes art great, but how do you know when you're done? Because you know you're done when you've created something that you know is going to move people in the way that you are hoping to move people, I imagine, right? And at least in my way as a songwriter, it's like you tell the story and you let the story move people rather than telling people what you think so much as let the story move people. But still, whether the story is going to move people depends on how well you've told it, and how do you know when you've succeeded in that? And I think it's, and I have no idea what your answers are going to be, because I think the medium you guys are working with is so different from mine, and it's so much less immediate. You write a song, you sing it, 3 minutes later, you know whether it worked, you know.
I just have to say that things that I did 50 years ago have come back big time, which is really strange. So things that I did about during the Vietnam War period and for the beginning of second wave feminism came back for the 50th anniversary into art shows and publications. And at the time I thought I was doing it this week, and you know, it went in the paper and then the paper went in the trash. It was an idea specific to a time. And then that's happened repeatedly, where things come back. People are contacting me to use artwork that I did 20 years ago and 10 years ago. And at the time, you know, I was just like, okay, I'm in my house and I'm doing this because I think, you know, this is what I'm thinking about. And I think it would be a good idea to do this. And so I think there's more of a lag time with us. there's the question of, you know, people buying the publication or using your artwork over and over again in a particular movement that happens in a shorter period of time. But I think it's a long, we're playing a long game.
Yeah, I mean, for this comic and for other things I've done, I think it's been like, I found a certain story really compelling. And so then I try to like really just get across what it is about it that I was so compelled by and hope that that resonates with other people also. But I do think like there's some just technical things of like, especially like the story we did for this, just clarity, because it's kind of like complicated and it's actually something that took place over like 30 years or more. We're doing it in like 4 pages. And so just like making it actually hang together, not only, I wanted it to work on the level of the people who were involved who would be reading it, but obviously also on the level of someone who maybe doesn't even live in New York and doesn't know anything about this. I think that was kind of a really big challenge. Yeah. And then I also was, I was trying to really focus on the clarity and then sort of just getting the story across, getting people to know these women that we were talking about. But then there's also, you also have to think about just like visual impact and like whether someone wants to like flip past it or if someone wants to actually read it. And so I don't know. Yeah. I think that there's just a lot to think about.
I mean, for this particular piece, I could have gone on for many pages. I had to reduce it. It's difficult for me to see anything as finished, frankly. You know, not to be silly about it, but it's almost like with art, you can see, even if it's a comic or a painting or, you know, even a piece of writing, the illusion of time, you know, because you can... You change and you see something you've done and you realize it needed much more. It could have much more. Maybe it wants much more, if you know, feel those kind of things. But I see that a lot with these. But there is a feeling that a work is completed, and especially if you have a story, like if the story itself, which is easier for me to see, you know, because there's an action, there's an event. If the event concludes, then you have some parameters. But otherwise, I mean, I was looking at some drawings this morning and I realized like there's so much more that could be added to them. It's horrible if you had them professionally photographed and, you know, prints made or something though. What are you going to do? But there is that. Comics are at least, the stories pitch off the ending. So I like that.
Yeah, I think Sasha sort of described really well for the comic that we did together. And I think just for me, there are sort of like two moments in it, like the piece that I just did for the No North Brooklyn Pipeline activists. It was like the first audience was showing Anna and Gabe the drawings that I had made of them and their struggle and the story to fight against this pipeline in Brownsville. And when they were like, oh, you even got my shoes right, like you got the freckle on my forehead, like it felt very sort of, there's sort of that first level of, did I represent you and your struggle right? And then the second level of, does it communicate with others and help sort of build the organizing for the struggle that we're engaged in? So that's it.
Well, I agree with Sue that in some ways, when you make art, you might find out years later, there is sort of a long game there. I do think, at least with certain types of art, you also can these days find out immediately with social media. not that you should, make all decisions based on how many likes you got, but, there is like kind of a really quick, poll going on about how much it resonates with people in your circle. In terms of making sure something has the impact that you want it to have, over time, I've had to really work on that. I wasn't really good at that at first. I do still, you know, if I am feeling kind of uncertain, then I will ask someone, not necessarily an artist, not that I don't respect artists' opinions, but more someone related to that field. So you know, if it's about indigenous rights, then I would ask someone that knew a lot about that and was involved in that struggle, how it resonated with them, rather than necessarily just asking another artist. So that's been kind of my strategy to make sure that something doesn't have like exactly the opposite intention of what I'm trying to put out there. But I also think, you know, if it's a similar intention, people can take their own interpretations, and I'm okay with that.
Susan, do you have maybe another brilliant question to ask everybody before we wrap up, perhaps?
I thought we were wrapping up.
I mean, we could wrap up, but this is going so well, and there's so many wonderful participants, and it feels like going a little longer would be nice if everybody's up for it.
Sure.
One more good question.
Well, I just like to point out, especially to people out there listening, that doing these stories is very, very time consuming. It takes me like months to do a 10-page story, like 5 months, between the research and the writing and making sure that the images go with the words and figuring out and then checking back with people. It's just a tremendously labor-intensive kind of thing. And when going back to what David was asking, I think it would be pretty much impossible to get to quantify in money how much labor goes into this kind of art. And yet we do it. And World War III has been going now since 1979. So there's and the people who do the artwork for it have changed, you know, over and over again, new people coming in, other people dropping off. This all happened before graphic novels were a thing. It was a predecessor, it was a forerunner, it was a pioneer of all of this. What do you think, everybody, about this whole idea of the amount of labor that goes into these, and are you hooked? Are you going to be continuing to do this?
I thought it was interesting what you said, Beck, about that like successful artist saying that she wishes she had more time for art, because I think like, yeah, it's like there's sort of a mythical like thing that you think of like, yeah, I'm just going to like have, if I could just get to some place where I have all the time in the world to do this and I don't have to worry about money or whatever other stuff. Yeah, and I don't know if that exists, but I definitely want to keep doing this. I really love doing it. And, you know, I think if it goes slowly, it goes slowly. And something, I mean, I sort of thought like when we were in our first lockdown that I was like, well, here you go. Like, I'm unemployed. Like, I have all the time in the world. And somehow, you know, it's interesting because it's just maybe it wasn't the right mental space. It's just, it wasn't the right inspiration. It sort of felt more like, it didn't feel like a very inspiring time necessarily. So, I mean, in some ways, maybe you need to have the other stuff going on to be inspired. But yeah, I definitely want to keep doing this stuff.
I always keep making art. I mean, I'm middle-aged now, and I haven't stopped. So, I mean, it's hard to say. It doesn't even seem like a choice. You know, I don't say that joyfully or regretfully. It's like the choice of, you know, a breathing or things. I do wish there was a way that we wouldn't have economic work. I've, you know, I've been very poor, and I've been high on the hog too. And I've noticed that, you know, there's a certain amount of money you make. Me feels like fortune, but it's actually a cutoff point unless you're pathologically greedy, and you no longer think about money. And all of a sudden, it's like when I moved to New York City years ago, and I didn't have a car. You know, you realize all of the cognitive space to get eaten up by worried about your serpentine belt or your radiator or your insurance or your license or all the rest of that. And so there's a certain amount of cognitive space, even spiritual space, to get eaten up thinking about money and bills. And those several times in my life where I made ample money, all of this, like I've spent days in the studio and tripped over, you know, that excess space that I used to worry about rent or worry about insurance or whatever. And when they come back, I feel the encroachment. So I won't quit. That's not even consideration. But I wish there was a way. I'm trying to get back to those moments of being high on the hog, but to help.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I've led a very rich movement-filled life so far, and I have a lot of stories that I want to draw. And it's wild the way that it's like I tore through the entire World War III Illustrated in one afternoon. It's like that is so many people's many months of labor. But then it's like reading a comic. I'm just like, so yeah, no, it's funny. But I have a piece I'm working on now too about Claudia Jones that I'm really excited about. And it's just, it's very slow, and there's a lot of stories to tell. And that is that.
I worried a little bit when I decided to not make art for a living that I would kind of lose my ability to gain inspiration from the universe, that the inspiration would just stop coming to me and I would be like blocked out of any of that floating inspiration in the air. But that didn't happen. It's just part of me. It's not going to stop. I do think comics are a lot of work. But I would love to continue, what I started in the World War III comic and make something about housing discrimination in Detroit or more broadly. But I would probably want a, researcher helper to do that aspect of it. Just in general, in terms of making artwork, I just continue to work, but slowly. And I just try to send out messages for, thank you for your patience. Thank you for your patience. As I slowly get my art together.
Slow art. This has been great, guys. I mean, thank you so much for being part of this discussion, and I hope we can do it again soon there's too much to talk about in too little time, but we've been here for a while, so I guess this has been a discussion with five of the contributors to the most recent issue of World War III Illustrated, which people can find at www.nyc, issue 51. And People can find this discussion archived at youtube.com/drovix in the discussions with playlist, discussions with David playlist, as well as in podcast form. If you look for This Week with David Rovix, wherever you got your podcasts. Thank you so much, everybody. And we'll just end the broadcast.
Thank you, Dave.